This is a Silver Bullet Security Podcast with Gary McGraw. I'm your host, Gary McGraw, CTO of Cigital and author of Software Security. This podcast series is co-sponsored by Cigital and IEEE Security and Privacy Magazine. For more, see www.computer.org/security and www.cigital.com/silverbullet. This is the 54th in a series of interviews with security gurus, and I am super pleased to have with me today Mark Donner. Hi, Mark.
Hey, Gary.
Mark Donner is Engineering Director for Google Health and Google Finance. He's also been involved with the integration of DoubleClick into Google. Dr. Donner has 30 years of experience in engineering hardware, software, and complex systems. He worked for many years at Morgan Stanley as an executive director and resident geek, and he also worked at IBM Research and JPL. Mark has a BS from Caltech and a PhD in computer science from CMU. He serves as Associate Editor-in-Chief of IEEE's Security and Privacy Magazine and is an active member of the IEEE, ACM, and USENIX. He's married, lives in New York City, and is the father of a teenager. He blogs at newyorkgeek.wordpress.com. So, thanks for joining us, Mark.
My pleasure.
Your career has a long arc. From the lab through high finance to dot-com land, what are the pros and cons of the different cultures you've worked in, and how have they shaped your thinking?
That's a really interesting question. Labs are very loose. They don't have the kind of resources that commercial enterprises do, but you have a lot of freedom. Once you decide you really want to get something done, though, you really need to go somewhere where people can put money down and build things. Mm-hmm. And once I got interested in large-scale distributed systems, I realized that I had to go from the research lab where I could think about them and talk about them and play with them at toy scale. But if I wanted to really get thousands of machines, I had to go somewhere where someone actually needed to use thousands of machines. So the commercial world is a place where you can actually get experience at scale. And once you decide you want to do something like that, you end up going there. And culturally, the business world is demanding. You got schedules, you got budgets, you got competition for resources. It's a tougher world. You got to be clearer about what you're doing and why than you do have to be in the research world.
How about differences between high finance land and, dot-com land?
The biggest difference between high finance land and dot-com land to me is in high finance land, a technologist is a cost center. In dot-com land, a technologist is a product generator, a revenue generator.
Right.
So you go from being, sort of a problem that you need to being a real value adder.
Very interesting. Very interesting. And how about the difference in kind of, what would you call it? The adult supervision factor, anything there?
The cultures are so different. It's hard, each organization has its own style. And my observation is that management adapts itself to the needs of the organization. I wouldn't say that they're definitely different in management style and adult supervision,
mm-hmm.
but I wouldn't say one is better or worse than the other. They're just very different.
Interesting. So switching gears a little, I always enjoyed your bibliotech column in Security and Privacy. Would you explain to the listeners what it was and some of the things you covered in bibliotech?
Sure. Let's see. Back in the days in 2002, 2003, when we were working on founding the magazine, I sent out a proposal to the then editorial board saying, we're trying to get our audience to step out of the prove a theorem box and think about not just technology, but also how it interacts with society at large. And engineers tend to have strong and often valuable opinions on those topics, but they tend also to be fairly reticent to express those, partly because you can't prove theorems about society, at least not yet. Maybe Harry Seldon will figure that out one of these days, but that ain't going on now. So
nice.
I sent a proposal around to the editorial board, which I expected them to laugh at and reject. That in order to sort of engage another part of the brain of the engineering community, we have a department in which we talk about science fiction articles with an eye towards using them as ways to provoke thought and discussion about engineering and our practice in the world. And to my total astonishment and delight, the editorial board, rather than laughing me out of the mailing list, said, yes, let's do it. Of course, that then put me on the spot to actually
right.
make it happen.
Put your money where your mouth is, Harry.
That's right. So I wrote, I guess there were 14 such articles that came out. I wrote 12 of them. It turned out to be harder to get people to write about science fiction than I thought. I had been thinking about the topic for a very long time. I used to read a tremendous amount of it. I still read a fair amount.
So if you had to pick one bibliotheque of the 12 that you wrote to share, which one would it be?
Oh, dear. That's a very tough question. I mean, they're all actually up on my blog, nygeek.wordpress.com. But which one would I share? I don't know. Maybe the first one, AI Bites Man.
Okay. And then what is your favorite, your most favorite recent sci-fi book? By recent, let's say anything after, I don't know, 2000.
Oh, most favorite. That's a very tough one. I would say Iron Sunrise or possibly Singularity Sky, one of those two.
Mm-hmm. Those are both good. I think I would say Accelerando, the Strauss book.
Yeah, yeah. Well, the other two are Strauss also, but that's a good argument. I don't know. The whole you know post singularity thing is a very interesting area to speculate, and some great science fiction has come out of that world. Gibson kind of anticipated it. I still think it goes back to Werner Vinge and True Names.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, these are amazing and important.
I just read True Names this year, believe it or not, because I'd read a lot of other stuff and finally found a copy of that.
Nice story. I think is one of the most important science fiction stories of the last 50 years.
And well, explain very briefly why you believe that's the case.
Well. It explores this whole question of singularity and of sort of a virtual universe that you experience through the large networks and
right.
through computers.
Right.
And it sort of challenges the perception of reality in ways that we can do now with networks and systems that was sort of a radical concept at the time.
I guess it came out early.
It was in the early 80s.
Yeah, wasn't the term cyberspace coined in that work? Seems that I recall
think the,
that.
The term cyberspace came from William Gibson I want to say Mona Lisa Overdrive or... No. It was one of the short stories.
I'm sure one of our listeners will set us straight forthwith.
Count zero, maybe.
So let's switch gears again. Cyber war, which is an aspect of cyberspace, I suppose, keeps persistently popping up in the U.S. public discourse, especially over the last year or so. Why do you suppose Americans like to talk about cyber war?
It's scary. It's exciting. We don't know much about it. We're more vulnerable to it as a society because of our sort of advanced adoption of computers compared to pretty much any other society. So we should be particularly alert to it. It's exciting and scary.
So the Stuxnet worm is getting a lot of press again.
It sure is.
And it was, it has attack code aimed directly at impacting a physical process by manipulating a programmable logic controller's ladder logic. As you know, the early stories were focusing only on how it got there and how it set up command and control. But it looks to me like an advanced cyber weapon. So do you think the genie's out of the bottle now?
I think the genie's been out of the bottle for a long time. What's more the case is that people are beginning to notice that the genie is out there,
right,
and get sort of concerned about it. The genie's been there quite a while.
So you used to work on real-time robotic control back in a previous existence. Did you ever worry about security when you were working on that stuff?
No, I had no clue. I didn't get involved in security until I went to Wall Street, and I was running a very large number of machines and discovered that I could, you know, I ran crack on the password file and got more than 70% of the passwords.
Mm-hmm.
And discovered that, in fact, my users, by and large, didn't know their passwords and were annoyed at the idea of having to know them.
Mm-hmm. You know, I was just at a meeting of a whole bunch of real-time process control people, and they're just getting started thinking about security. I think they're taking it very seriously, but it's not something that has been built into those systems by any stretch of the imagination.
No, I agree. I've been told stories about various interesting systems that impact large portions of the economy where security is not only an afterthought, it's not pressed at all.
Mm-hmm.
It's never been thought about.
Mm-hmm.
Lots of interesting problems to work on.
I guess that's one of the things that makes cyber war so captivating as a topic, because we know what some of the vulnerabilities are, and what could really happen is kind of shocking.
Well, the only good news in that is that a lot of the things that are particularly weak are also fairly low on the automation scale, so they're not nearly as vulnerable as the stuff that, for example, Stuxnet was aimed at.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about Stuxnet just a little bit more. So how about if we contrast Stuxnet with something like the DDoS attacks a la Estonia, or cyber espionage attacks that I can't name, and so on? Do you think things are getting more serious with this, you know, process control stuff?
Well, what's happening is that, you know, if you look at the evolution of this stuff in the bad old days, you know, floppy disks were the primary vector, and you know, virulence was low, the hazard level was low. It was mostly an annoyance.
Mm-hmm.
Once the commercial internet, the consumer internet, really got going, and it became easier to install software because the systems were designed around easily installation, suddenly we got greater virulence, but it was still not particularly hostile. It was more, hey, look what I can do, Ma.
Mm-hmm.
Then we got people discovering, hey, I could put zombies up there. I can actually make a business model around it.
I can write a whole bunch of boxes and build a botnet.
Yeah, and I can actually make money out of it, and I can hire them out, you know, from little websites, take credit cards, and I can do all kinds of stuff, and it's become an entire ecosystem. I mean, it's mostly populated by organized crime, but it's making a lot of money. I mean, there's companies in places where they write malware, and the company has an HR department, and they send the engineers out on paintball expeditions. I mean, this is not, it's not three guys in a garage. It's an industry.
Mm-hmm.
It's a little scary. And now what we're seeing is, you know, if not national actors, we're certainly seeing very well-heeled actors,
mm-hmm,
doing what we originally started calling spear phishing. Actually, it's not spear phishing, but it's targeted attacks.
Right.
Highly targeted. Yeah. Either targeted at individuals or targeted at systems or targeted at whatever. This is the sort of the future of this kind of thing. You know, we are really vulnerable. Our defenses historically have been kind of statistical, you know, kind of safe sex, safe computing, right? And the reality is that if somebody wants to get me personally,
mm-hmm,
there's not a whole lot that anybody can do about it.
Right. I kind of liken it to you're on a huge stage with lots and lots of people, and there's a very, very tight spotlight. And if it just is, you know, if it gets aimed at you, you're toast.
Right. And we have no defenses. We haven't thought about this problem. We just don't know what's going to happen there.
We'll be right back after this message. The landmark 50th episode of the Silver Bullet Security Podcast with Gary McGraw is an interview with cybersecurity luminary Richard A. Clark. The episode was recorded in high-definition video and is available on the Silver Bullet website, www.sigital.com/silverbullet, as well as on YouTube. Make sure to check out the video. So let's switch gears a little bit again. We're all busy trying to automate healthcare and healthcare records, which is something you're working on now. Are we crazy?
It depends on what you're worried about. when I first took the healthcare the Google Health assignment here, I worried a lot about the privacy concerns, mm-hmm. and had a conversation with a colleague who's a public health guy in the UK. And he said, you guys are sort of obsessed with the wrong thing. The reality is that, you know, in the UK, we're even more cuckoo about privacy than you guys are in the States. But people aren't nearly as obsessed with healthcare privacy in the UK because in the UK, you know, derogatory information about your health can't cause you to lose your healthcare coverage mm-hmm. or, you know, get you fired from your job. Mm-hmm. And in fact, the obsession with the privacy of health information is pretty much restricted to the U.S., where, you know, pre-existing condition stuff and a bunch of other things like that can really clobber you. So people do, you know, rightly have a very sensitive view of that sort of stuff.
I think, everybody should be worried about accuracy, though, which is certainly part of security.
Well, in fact, one of the studies we did was of the quality of the data that's flowing around. And, you know, for example, one of my colleagues pointed out that the number of medication names where the Hamming distance between two names for different compounds is one is frighteningly large.
No doubt.
If you think of that as a system design failure, uh-huh. There's a perfect example of that.
Yeah.
You know, it's got nothing to do with the privacy of one's data. It's got to do with sort of fundamental systemic error. You know, when you change an E to an A and you change a drug from something that's beneficial to something that's toxic, mm-hmm. you got to worry about those kinds of things.
Mm-hmm. But by and large, do you believe that our push to automate is beneficial
absolutely.
Activity?
There's no doubt about it. I mean, everybody who's thought about the fundamental operation of the healthcare system, doctors, public health people, pretty much anybody who's really looked closely at it, mm-hmm. Sees this as sort of a huge, important step forward.
See, that's an important thing for security types to understand, because we often get so obsessed with not naysaying, but stopping these activities from going forward without thinking about the benefits that they're bringing us.
Well, here's an example. A colleague of mine got a phone call one night, about 10 o'clock at night. For the purpose of conversation, his father's name is Joe. Phone rings. He answers it. Hello. Hi, are you Joe's son? Yes.
Yeah.
Well, do you know what meds your father is on? He's here in the emergency room, and he's not conscious, and
wow.
We're trying to figure out what's going on with him. So if, you know, Joe and his son had medical records online and Joe had shared his with his son, he could have looked it up and said, oh, yes, this is the list.
Right.
Instead, you know, I've talked with ER people, you know, they tell people to drive over to someone's house and look in their medicine cabinet and read the labels to them on the phone.
Yeah, craziness.
That's how they do this stuff these days.
Seems like the old days. We're living in the old days. So what was it like to testify before the National Committee on Vital and Health Statistics? And who the heck are they anyway?
So let's see. That was a while back. They were they're a piece of Health and Human Services.
Okay.
And they were looking at personal health record systems. And it turns out that untethered personal health records were not imagined by the people who wrote the HIPAA law back in the early 1990s, mm-hmm. which was, if you remember back that far, which I'm having trouble doing sometimes, was back before the consumer world had ever seen the internet.
Uh-huh.
So HIPAA was written without any real conception of digital sharing of information. And it doesn't adapt itself particularly well to that. And so these guys were trying to figure out whether, you know, you could simply declare that personal health record operators could be compelled to, in some simple way, to obey HIPAA. And we argued that, in fact, the HIPAA law doesn't really have the right core design
mm-hmm.
and needs to be thought through a bit. So I think, you know, this was a process by which some very, very smart, very dedicated policymaking people were trying to get their heads around what had to be done to get it right.
Gathering real data, yeah.
Gathering, yeah, talking to people who are really struggling with the systems issues now.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Okay, so switching gears again, last gear switch. What is your feeling about the state of personal liberty and our need for security? They seem to balance very badly from where I sit on the Shenandoah River. What do you think?
Well, I've been thinking a lot about this question. So I'll transform your question slightly to think about the question of privacy. 100 years ago, making a dossier on Gary McGraw, aside from the fact that he didn't exist, was a very big undertaking because everything was on paper and gathering the information together took forever and cost a phenomenal amount. So your privacy was essentially protected by the economics of information systems
mm-hmm.
of the day.
Mm-hmm.
Today, violating your privacy is relatively straightforward. Not that straightforward, but it's actually much more achievable economically than it was. So finally, we're now actually beginning to have a conversation in society at large about privacy. What I find disappointing is that far too many of the conversations about privacy are not real reasoned discourse, but rather screaming and shouting about you're violating privacy by doing X or Y or Z. Rather than, gee, what does privacy mean, and, you know, who owns the data, whose privacy is being violated, what are they trying to achieve, and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
That's a harder problem, and we're not really thinking about it very effectively.
Well, and I think that leaves us open to, you know, fear-mongering and kind of a power grab by people in the name of security, kind of nanny state mentality type stuff. I don't know if you agree with that.
There is a certain amount of that going on. Well, you know, when screaming and shouting without sort of any underlying reasoning process drives decision making, yeah, that's what happens.
Mm-hmm.
You get irrational responses. And I think, you know, the political environment in a lot of parts of the world right now is so polarized that it's hard to actually have rational conversations about some of these difficult issues.
Right, right. So let's pull this down to something extremely personal. What do you do about your teenage son's internet use?
Starting when he was quite a bit younger, I don't restrict it in any way.
Uh-huh.
Because I figure he's smarter than me. He's a lot more motivated than me, and at the very least, he can go to someone else's house.
Right.
So I don't, in fact, restrict his access. What mm-hmm. I do and have done since he was young enough to, old enough to have the conversation, is talk to him about what's going on out there, what's really fundamentally possible and impossible, what mm-hmm. the risks are.
Mm-hmm.
And in the early days, he would sort of show me things that he had come across that bothered him, and I would sort of try to talk him through what that was.
Right.
You know, the crucial question in terms of internet access for a young person is making sure that they're going to come to you when they feel threatened.
Right.
So that you can consult with them on it. If they stop believing you're on the same side with them, you've lost. It doesn't matter. You can chain them to the floor in their room and you still lost.
Well put. Thanks very much. So two last questions, and you know these are always flyers. And the first one is, are you any relation to the Donner Party Donners?
Well, back in the days when the Donner Party made their trip across Donner Pass, my family kept kosher.
I'm not sure how to take that one, Mark. We could take that in all sorts of directions. most important and last question, who is holding the syrup attack token currently?
That's a very interesting story. So someone, and I don't remember who, promised to deliver it to Ron Citron's parents' house.
I see.
And I handed it over to this fellow, and it was never seen again.
Huh.
So there was a new bottle of syrup that was created by Ron by going to the supermarket, which he sent to University of Washington, where it appeared on the visitor desk that I was sitting at one day back in the 80s.
Mm-hmm.
But that was clearly a false syrup token.
Well, you know, let the record show that the syrup token is being sought.
Clearly so.
Thanks, Mark. It's been fun.
Thank you, Gary. A lot of fun.
This has been a Silver Bullet Security Podcast with Gary McGraw. Silver Bullet is co-sponsored by Cigital and IEEE Security and Privacy Magazine and syndicated by Inform IT. The September-October issue of IEEE S&P features articles on embedded in cyber-physical systems. Subscribe today at www.computer.org/security. Show links, notes, and an online discussion can be found on the Silver Bullet webpage at www.cigital.com/silverbullet. This is Gary McGraw.